Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Baruch Spinoza, narrated by Charlton Heston, Part 3.
In the 17th century, common Judeo-Christian tradition held that God, exercising his free will, had decided some thousands of years ago to create the world. Spinoza thinks that virtually every aspect of this traditional account is demonstrably false. He gives reasons for his conclusions. First, the biblical account is anthropomorphic. That is, it attributes human characteristics to God. Second, this view suggests that God has purposes, makes decisions, and possesses something called free will. Third, tradition views the creation as having occurred at a specific time in the past. Finally, the biblical account suggests that God is distinct from his creation. Spinoza explicitly argues against the traditional view on each of these points. The Hebrew Bible, which Christians refer to as the Old Testament, often attributes human characteristics to God. God is said in Genesis chapter 3, verse 8, to have walked around in the Garden of Eden as if he were a being who could walk. Human emotions are attributed to God, as when he's said to be jealous or that he gets angry. God is said to have a voice and a face. Spinoza argues that this biblical image of God is deeply confused. God, being infinite, cannot intelligibly be portrayed as having the finite physical form of a human being.
Everyone who has to any extent contemplated the divine nature denies that God is corporeal. By body, we understand any quantity with length, breadth, and depth, limited by some certain figure. Nothing more absurd than this can be said of God, that is, of a being absolutely infinite.
For these same reasons, Spinoza rejects the traditional view that God is either male or female. But even theologians who realized that God does not have a body still persisted in attributing to God human mental characteristics such as intellect, will, desire, and emotions. Spinoza thinks such views lead only to confusion. The sort of intellect and will that an infinite and eternal being might have would be entirely different from those possessed by finite, dependent beings such as ourselves. Spinoza says,
"The intellect and will that would constitute God's essence would have to be vastly different from human intellect and will, and would have no point of agreement except the name. They could be no more alike than the celestial constellation of the dog and the dog that barks."
Spinoza wrote in Latin, and when translating his texts into English, it's impossible to avoid the traditional pronoun he when referring to God. But in fact, as we've seen, Spinoza does not view God as a person at all. When someone wrote to him objecting to the impersonal character of his concept of God, Spinoza responded that people tend to think of God as a person because they project onto the divine those characteristics that they see as a human's best qualities.
"I believe that a triangle, if only it had the power of speech, would say in like manner that God is eminently triangular. And a circle would say that the divine nature is eminently circular. And in this way, each thing would ascribe its own attributes to God and make itself like unto God."
The biblical creation story suggests that at some point God decided to create the world. This decision has most often been interpreted as an act of God's free will. But Spinoza rejects the claim that God has free will, and his arguments are rooted deep in his basic philosophy. For one thing, it seems to Spinoza that attributing free will to God is one more case of anthropomorphically ascribing to God that which humans think are their own best characteristics. But more important, Spinoza says that in this instance, the traditionalists are wrong, not only about the nature of God, but also about themselves as human beings. According to Spinoza, there is no such thing as free will, divine or human. When we say that someone's acted of his own free will, we usually mean it was possible under the circumstances to make a different choice. Many philosophers have concluded that an act of free will cannot be fully determined by outside causes. Spinoza's view that all things in nature are part of a single, unified, causal system leads him to deny that there can be any such thing as free will. If human will were free in this sense, we would be able to determine our own natures. We would be causes of ourselves, so to speak, and thus each of us would be substances. But Spinoza holds firmly that there can be only one substance, one infinite entity which is cause of itself. Descartes said that each human mind is a substance, and that each mind has an unlimited power of free will. But Spinoza disagrees on this. Our minds and bodies are not substances, he says. They are modes of the one infinite substance. They're parts of the whole of nature, where other things and the unchanging laws of nature determine the existence and actions of each mind and body. Thus, he denies free will exists.
In the mind, there is no absolute or free will, but the mind is determined to will this or that by a cause, which is also determined by another, and this again by another, and so on to infinity.
Spinoza knows that most people believe they have free will, and he tries to explain how they've come to such a mistaken notion.
Men think themselves free because they are conscious of their volitions and their desires, but they do not think, even in their dreams, of the causes which determine them to want and desire, for they are ignorant of these causes.
In a famous letter, Spinoza uses the example of a stone to illustrate his meaning.
Let us think of a very simple thing. For example, a stone receives from an external cause which impels it a certain quantity of motion, with which it will afterwards necessarily continue to move even when the impact of the external cause has ceased. What is here said of the stone must be understood of each individual thing, that is, that each thing is necessarily determined by an external cause to exist and to act in a definite and determinate manner.
Then, for purposes of illustration, Spinoza fancifully asks us to imagine what the stone would think if it had a mind like ours.
Next, conceive, if you please, that the stone, while it continues in motion, thinks and knows that it is striving to continue in motion. Surely this stone, inasmuch as it is conscious only of its own effort, will believe that it is completely free and that it continues in motion for no other reason than because it wants to. And such is the human freedom which all men boast that they possess, and which consists solely in this, that men are conscious of their desires and are ignorant of the causes by which they are determined.
Now, of course, God's activity is not determined by external causes. God, as substance, is entirely self-determining. In this sense, then, God is completely free. Indeed, using Spinoza's understanding of the true meaning of the term freedom, only God can be entirely free.
That thing is called free, which exists from the necessity of its own nature alone, and is determined to act by itself alone.
Clearly, only God, that is, substance, satisfies these conditions. But Spinoza insists that this kind of true freedom is very different from what we call free will. Free will, as we mean it, involves the ability to choose, to act or not act, to be or not to be, as we decide. But God couldn't choose not to produce the world. The world follows from the infinite nature of God, just as it follows from the nature of a triangle that its angles are equal to two right angles. Moreover, if free will means we act or fail to act according to our desires and purposes, then to say that God has free will would be to suggest that God has desires or purposes. But Spinoza thinks that attributing desires to God contradicts his nature as an infinite being. Infinite things necessarily flow in infinite ways from God. What could such a God possibly desire? Indeed, Spinoza says that the view that God acts from some purpose is impious.
This doctrine takes away God's perfection. For if God acts for the sake of an end, he necessarily wants something which he lacks.
Of course, it's absurd to suggest that the infinite and eternal God is lacking something. God does not act for a purpose. The universe, which is his active self-expression, is also without purpose. According to Spinoza, then, God did not create the world by an act of free will, nor did he do so to satisfy some desire or to accomplish some purpose. On the contrary, the world flows inexorably from the necessity of God's nature, as the truths of geometry follow inexorably from the initial premises of the system. For this reason, too, Spinoza says it's irrational to suggest that the creation was a singular event which occurred at some particular time. The relationship between God and the world, in Spinoza's view, is not a temporal relationship at all. It makes no more sense to ask when the creation took place than to ask when 2 plus 2 began to equal 4. Such matters are eternal, that is, they have no relationship to time. Finally, Spinoza objects to the idea suggested by the traditional account of creation that God wholly transcends the world. Spinoza thinks it's evident that nothing could, as it were, lie outside the compass of an infinite being. Thus, in his view, all things must be in God, and God's power must be actively, causally present in all things. In a passage near the end of part one of the Ethics, Spinoza sums up his views.
In these propositions, I have explained the nature and properties of God, that he exists necessarily, that he is one and singular, that he exists and acts solely from the necessity of his own nature, that he is the free cause of all things and in what manner, that all things are in God and so depend on him that without him they could neither be nor be conceived. And finally, that all things have been predetermined by God, not through his free will or good pleasure, but through his absolute nature or infinite power.
This is Spinoza's understanding of God. In retrospect, it's no wonder that both Jewish and Christian defenders of the faith were hostile to his philosophy. Their most deeply held convictions about God, morality, and human salvation were based upon the anthropomorphic concept of God they found in the Bible. In denying the existence of such a God, Spinoza seemed to be denying the truth of Holy Scripture itself. The Calvinist clergy's disagreement with Spinoza also involved more than theology alone. In the Netherlands, as in all of Europe during the 17th century, religion was inextricably bound up with struggles for political power. As we will see, to understand the hostility of the church towards Spinoza's views is to understand something of the political situation in the Netherlands in the middle of the 17th century. When Spinoza was writing in the 1660s, a century and a half had passed since Luther sparked the Reformation in Germany. This had been a century and a half of ceaseless war and strife between Catholics and Protestants all over Europe. The provinces of the Low Countries had not been spared the destruction and bloodshed wrought by the wars of religion. In fact, the very existence of the country called the Netherlands resulted from a protracted 40-year revolt in which the Low Country provinces won their independence from the Habsburg Empire. Philip II, who'd ruled over the Netherlands from his capital in Spain, had been a staunch Roman Catholic. He'd viewed every deviation from Catholic orthodoxy as a treasonous affront to his sovereignty. His unwillingness to permit Calvinists and other Protestants to worship openly within the lands of his empire was a major cause of the province's war for independence. But as so often happens, once independence was won, the Calvinists themselves began agitating to have all forms of religious service other than their own outlawed in their new republic. By the middle of the 17th century, there were two clearly opposing factions in Dutch politics. On the one hand, there were the Republicans, as they were called, led by Jan de Witt. De Witt and his Republicans supported the governmental status quo and favored religious and intellectual freedom. On the other side were the monarchists, backed by the clergy, who wanted William of Orange to be king and wanted to establish Calvinism as the official state church. Spinoza supported the Republicans, and there's some evidence that he and De Witt were personal friends. In the early 1660s, De Witt was comfortably in control of the government, and all seemed well. But the preachers were always on hand in times of trouble to tell their congregations that the nation's problems were a sign of God's displeasure with the heresies in their midst. From his letters, it's clear that Spinoza was working full-time on the Ethics from 1663 to 1665. But a letter from a friend written in September of 65 indicates that Spinoza had begun a new project.
I see that you are not so much philosophizing as, if I may say so, theologizing. For you are writing down your thoughts about angels, prophecy, and miracles.
Apparently, the correspondent had learned that Spinoza had broken off his work in the Ethics and begun a work with the imposing title Tractatus Theologico-Politicus, a theological-political treatise. Spinoza wrote back, explaining,
I am now writing a treatise about my interpretation of Scripture. This I am driven to do for the following reasons. Firstly, the prejudices of the theologians, for I know that these are among the chief obstacles which prevent men from directing their mind to philosophy. Secondly, the opinion which the common people have of me, who do not cease to accuse me falsely of atheism. Thirdly, the freedom of philosophizing and of saying what we think. This I desire to vindicate in every way, for here it is always suppressed through the excessive authority and impudence of the preachers.
By defending the freedom of thought and expression against the agitation of the clergy, Spinoza was taking a clear stand in favor of the Republicans on the major political issue of his time. The clergymen based their claims on the authority of Scripture, which was seen as divinely inspired and literally and infallibly true. Spinoza knew that to get to the root of these claims, he'd have to investigate the Bible itself in order to ascertain just what authority it has and what doctrines it teaches. So he undertook a full-scale interpretive study of the Scriptures and produced what is now recognized as the first example of modern critical biblical scholarship. This approach does not rely on the clergy or on tradition for interpretation. It studies the Bible as an historical document using the methods of the literary scholar, the linguist, the historian, and the anthropologist. Spinoza was in a good position to undertake such a study, for he knew the Hebrew language well. He also was thoroughly familiar from his childhood days with the part of the Bible written in Hebrew. Devoting himself entirely to his task, Spinoza set aside the Ethics and spent 5 years of his life studying the Scriptures and recording his interpretation of what he found. The preface to Spinoza's theological-political treatise reminds the reader that in all ages, despotic rulers and demagogues have used superstition, wrapped in the garb of religion, to control the minds and hearts of the multitudes. Spinoza points out that the true teachings of Christianity regrettably have been distorted into pretexts for war and sectarian strife.
I have often wondered that people who make a boast of professing the Christian religion, namely love, joy, peace, and charity to all men, should quarrel with such rancorous animosity and display daily toward one another such bitter hatred that this, rather than the virtues they claim, is the readiest criterion of their faith.
As different clerics tried to outdo one another in claiming unquestionable divine authority for their difficult doctrines, the people naturally became confused. Spinoza notes that since religious doctrines are so often utterly contrary to reason, the clerics had to argue that divine truth is contrary to our God-given powers of reason.
Faith has become a mere compound of credulity and prejudices. Aye, prejudices too, which degrade man from rational being to beast, which completely stifle the power of judgment between true and false, which seem, in fact, carefully fostered for the purpose of extinguishing the last spark of reason. Piety, great God, and religion are become a tissue of ridiculous mysteries. Men who flatly despise reason, who reject and turn away from understanding as naturally corrupt, these, I say, these of all men are thought, oh lie most horrible, to possess light from on high.
Noting that most of these dangerous men claim scriptural authority for their divisive doctrines, Spinoza describes his own intentions.
I determined to examine the Bible afresh, in a careful, impartial, and unfettered spirit, making no assumptions concerning it, and attributing to it no doctrines which I do not find clearly therein set down. With these precautions, I constructed a method of scriptural interpretation, and thus equipped, proceeded to inquire.
This is the end of part 3. Please download part 4 to continue.